Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball, where we tell stories, where we learn about people. And if you listened to part one, you got to know Kim English, who's the new head coach at George Mason University. And a guy who grew up in Baltimore. If you're just tuning in, you're like, well, what is he talking about? Just go download, listen to part one. It was amazing. I mean, his recall is crazy. His story about overcoming his stutter, also really, really impressive. And just his overall rise. This is part two. And you'll hear about Kim and how he rose so quickly in the coaching profession to where now at 32 years old, he's a head coach at a place that's been to a Final Four in the last 15 years. Like, it's, the whole thing is crazy. So we'll get to that in a second. I want to give you just a couple of quick thoughts. When I watch basketball games, I don't know if you're like me, I learn something. Now, you know, I've always been this way watching Steph since he got to the NBA and maybe even in college, where you're more surprised when he misses than when he makes, regardless of the difficulty of the shot. But I think the Warriors, and not sure if they would have been there this year had Klay not torn his Achilles tendon. Obviously, a lot of it depends upon Klay and coming back, but he'll have plenty of time off. If you look at Kevin Durant's comeback, and you start to realize that while Klay is a great athlete and a great shooter and needs that balance and that push off, it's not like he's Ja Morant or one of these absolute athletic freaks where if he loses a half step because of the Achilles and the knee, it kills him. I want you to take a second, take a breath, and realize that the Warriors are close. Next year, Wiseman will be a second-year player. He only played three games in college. He had no summer league. He had a very limited training camp. And he didn't have Klay Thompson. I think Jordan Poole has a chance to be a tremendous player. I don't know if Wiggins, especially with his contract, is the end-all be-all. But if Wiggins is their fourth best player, that's a pretty good team. And that's with Wiseman as their fifth best player. Of course, a lot of it depends upon Klay and what he comes back at. The other thing is, can we say something about the conditioning of Steph Curry? To move like that for as long as he does, like the off-the-ball movement is not only incredible, but to do it and make shots means you have to be in unbelievable physical condition, which he is. I mean, something like, look, LeBron obviously is as well, but I think it's more difficult when you're moving off the ball with the speed, quickness, the physicality of the NBA. If I was going to make one adjustment, or point out one thing that I think the Warriors could have done when they're down 3 points. Like, look, Steph nearly got a look passing and then cutting off of Draymond Green. But ask anybody in the NBA and they'll tell you that the hardest time guarding Steph Curry is when he doesn't have the ball because you can't see him. And when they needed a bucket, he brought the ball up the floor, which allows the defense to set and know where he is. So I think if there were two adjustments that Steve Kerr could have made, one would be have something in the arsenal for that very time of the game where Steph doesn't have the ball and then he works to get it. I mean, look, it was there was a terrible moving screen call on Draymond Green. I mean, I don't care how hard he fouled LeBron James. It's doubly punitive if that's some sort of makeup or an additional call on Draymond because one of the Lakers took a dive. The other one, though, is with 2.2 seconds to go when they call a timeout and they run a play, Andrew Wiggins is wide open in the weak side corner. Of course, in front of the Lakers bench, that's a hard pass to make. But you have one of the great passing big men in the history of the league in Draymond Green. And he's a non-threat to shoot the basketball. So basically, you have two options here, as I see it. One, tell Draymond to shoot when you're down three because he's going to be wide open. Or two, have Draymond pass the ball inbounds. And he likely would have seen Andrew Wiggins wide open on the weak side. I still like the Lakers, even though they didn't play well, to advance past the Phoenix Suns. I'll get you some more picks once we have the brackets all set. And if you don't see the Warriors getting better, I can't help you. Jordan Poole's a player now. Wiseman's going to get better. If Klay comes back in any sort of form close to Klay Thompson in the past, which is a lot, missing 2 years and two catastrophic injuries, I think the Warriors are going to be right there and competitive next year for the entire thing. You can check out the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12, 3 Pacific, FoxSportsRadio.com, iHeartRadio app, SiriusXM 217, 203. Without further ado, let's get to part two of my discussion with Kim English.
Yeah, actually, you know what? I want to start with something that I'm guessing you do, that I do. I watch basketball. I try and learn something from every time I watch basketball. Did you stay up and watch the Laker game last night?
I did.
What? Give me a takeaway.
Just, I mean, honestly, the start of the game was, I guess, really impactful to me. You know, I tweeted it. I tweeted it to young players. I said, you know, oftentimes I've been on teams that, you know, weren't great. Like, I've coached teams that weren't great three-point shooting teams. But I've said, like, in staff meetings before, like, I think we would be a better shooting team if we were a better passing team. And at the start of that game, just the way the ball was flying around for Golden State, I mean, and Bazemore and Toscano Anderson, and Steph, all of their catches were so clean and great looks and led to makes. And, you know, that's why they jumped up. But I was kind of in and out of the game. I just got home from working out. So I actually ran and took a shower at halftime. And I came back and I was texting with our guys, kind of clipping stuff up on my laptop. So I was kind of in and out of the game in the second half. I watched the last 2 minutes locked in, really.
It's funny. I do with kids. And I would do it with a college team too. I do this thing. I call it, you know, everybody knows what the golden rule is, right? Mm-hmm. Do unto others as you want done unto you.
Yeah.
And I think passing is the same.
Yeah.
You know, that you demand, do you want to pass at your knees? Or you want to pass in the pocket, right?
It's everything. And it's everything in basketball, everything, you know, everything as far as your teammate, you know, at Tennessee, we had the saying called Enom. It's not about me. And, you know, the Spurs, you know, Greg Popovich says, you know, to be a Spur, you have to get over yourself, understanding it's not about you. And the ironic thing about that is, if you can truly get over yourself and if you can really live by the creed, it's not about me, you would then have 14 other guys only thinking about you. All your teammates are worried about your success. So it's everything in our game, man. I think that is basketball nirvana when you can get that accomplished.
But it's interesting though, because when you think back to when you're a player, like, I was an incredibly unselfish player, but still very much in my own head about my own game, right? It's why I think you can be great at this, because you're not so far removed that you don't remember all the things going on outside or even in your brain. And yet you're trying to, during those 40 minutes, trying to not make it about you.
You got to speak those things to power, you know, and that has been a cool thing being a young coach. Like, I know exactly what they're thinking when they're thinking it. Like, you know, I've walked in a locker room after we won a game and one of our top six players had a terrible game. And I see him kind of pouting in the locker room after a win. Address it right then. Hey, look, man, on this team, we win a game. I don't care if you fake it. You better fake it in this locker room and act happy. And I understand performance matters, but we won this game. We won this game. So when you get in your car or back in your dorm and you talk to your dad, you know, pardon my language, bitch and moan then. Like, not in this locker room.
Yeah.
Because that stuff leads to really bad teams. Because now what's going to happen the next game when the kid who played well this game plays bad, but we won, but you played good? Like, I want every single thing you do, man. Like, when our team's together, it's not about you. Now, like, it's times in basketball you have to be selfish as an individual and in a team. Like, you know, you need to be selfish. You need to want to make every single free throw you shoot. You can be selfish going for rebounds. I want you to be selfish. If you want to be selfish and you think you're our best defender, you want to guard the other team's best guy, be selfish. Be selfish as an individual. Be selfish and want to have a good shooting percentage. Get in the gym on your own. Work on your game. Like, be dedicated to your craft. But when we come together as a team, you have to let that go. And I've lived it. I've lived it. You know, I was selfish. I had an agenda my junior year in college. I wanted to score, and I thought I could, because I was on draft boards after my sophomore year. I thought I could go, and I had a terrible year, 10 points per game, bad percentages. And going into my last year, I let all that stuff go. And it was remarkable, like the success I had, because your teammates know it. Your teammates know if you're only worried about yourself, you know, and your teammates also know if, like, I had a thing. If I ever went to a teammate to, like, coach him during the game, I never made it about me. I would always say, hey, man, when you open, you got to shoot that. Hey, bro, if you run harder, I can hit you on that, you know, that kick head to the corner. Hey, bro, look for Ricardo when he's rolling. Like, they're not tagging him. They're staying with me on my field behind. Like, look for Ricardo. The roll's open. Like, so if every time I went to my teammate, it was only about them, never about me, what happened was Phil and Mike and Marcus, like, they, Steve Moore, like, they started to want to see my success. And I want that to be realized on our teams here.
I'll tell you one other thing I saw is, Caruso's not a good shooter. I know he's become a good enough shooter to where they can play him, but he's an unbelievable cutter. Just an unbelievable cutter. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if people understand how valuable that is. And, you know, within what I try and teach kids to do in terms of it's about selflessness, right? When you cut, even if you're not open, not only does the defender, he can't pay attention to the ball, but then there's usually a secondary defender that has to help. So while that's like a selfish act really for Caruso to go like, hey, I can't really shoot here. I'm kind of open, but not open. If I cut, now all of a sudden everything else opens up. It's a selfish because if I cut, they don't guard me, I get the ball moved, but it's really unselfish because it opens up everything for everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, he's at 40 this year from three, which is great. Caruso is, but yeah, no,
that's, it's crazy that, like, late in the game, he hit the side of the backboard on a three, right? Yeah. Like, no, he's
impactful, man. I mean, that cut he made one of the biggest plays in the game. It was when LeBron came off that middle ball screen going to the right, and LeBron kind of jumped up, and I mean, it was a drive, but I kind of look at that as a cut. You know, he caught it on a run. I call it a go catch. Like, if you're not, you know, you are running before you catch the ball, and he kind of broke through and he dumped it off to AD for the dunk. Like, I look at that as a cut. You know, Kyle Singler, I played with in Detroit, was like that. I mean, just everyone wanted to play with him. You know, we signed a kid that's coming here to George Mason, Devontae Gaines from Tennessee, where, you know, if you look at his stats at Tennessee, you won't see the impact. But watch him in practice every day. You can really see the impact. And cutting is something that he does really well.
Okay, so when we last talked, you talked about sending scouting reports for 2 years to Frank Haith at Tulsa about, and just completely detailed going through synergy. Mm-hmm. Okay. So your first year, you hang it up. What's it like to now be a coach, to be on staff your first year?
That was great. It was great. I felt like I was back in the league. Now I felt like I was in a new environment, and, you know, I get most excited in environments where I feel like I'm learning. And I was just soaking it all up. And I was, you know, I was taking myself, my mind back into a college state, you know, for, you know, playing pro for 3 years, not long, but, you know, taking myself back to the college game, relearning the college game, the rules, the shot clock had changed from 35 to 30 my first year back coaching in college. So it was great. It was an awesome experience to learn from Coach Haith and Coach Felton, and Mike Schwartz was there.
It was unbelievable. Give me entire who was on the staff, because I remember it being
Dave Lato. Awesome. Dave Lato had just left. So Mike Schwartz came from Fresno State, who was there for a year.
He was, and I know Schwartz, he was at Texas as a walk on when I was playing, right?
Yeah. He played in that game. They beat you guys you guys beat them, where they were gonna win the Big 12 championship, but you guys beat them, I think, in 99 maybe or 2000. It was a game
in the tournament.
No. It was regular season. You guys lost that game? Okay. Well, he talks about it, whatever. But yeah, so Mike Schwartz was there. Dennis Felton was there. Shea Seals, who was a great player at Tulsa, was there. And obviously Coach Haight.
So what's that like in terms of the coach's office and a meeting, right? Like you're not only a bright guy, but you played in the NBA, you played for Frank, right? Then you have other guys that have been doing it longer. How do you, I think the question is like, how do you contain your enthusiasm? How do you, cause like now you're low man on the pecking order.
Yeah. It's cool. See, I don't need, like, I have no ego when it comes to that stuff. And I make it known. And it's, I think it's so important in college basketball stats because, you know, so many people are in this business for the wrong reason. So many people are in this business to get ahead. So many people are in this business to make money, to like serve their own self-serving interests, like push their recruit ahead. But like, it was known right away that I cared about none of that. All I cared about was us being the best team we could possibly be and Frank Haith having as much success as he could possibly have. Like, that was it. That was it. And I thought that Tulsa was the best job in the country. I wasn't looking for another job. I wouldn't have left. Like, you know, funny story. A coach at the Peach Jam came up to me after my first year at Tulsa and asked me if I was interested in going to a program that's been in the Final Four multiple times in the last few years. And like, I was at Tulsa and like this, I said, no, I'm good. Like, I was in a learning state and I was happy. I didn't, and my mind didn't understand about advancement in the business and I was good. Like, so I was just entrenched in making our players as good as they could be, making our program as good as it can be, helping Coach Haith have as much success as he could have. And so I didn't even care about where my rank was within the staff. If I saw something, I said something. You know, if I seen something in the player, I went to that player. You know, if I disagree with someone in a staff meeting, I said it. If I didn't like your recruit, I would say it. If I did like your recruit, I would say it. It was great honesty and transparency. And, you know, that's what I've tried to create on every staff I've been on and I want to create here at Mason.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
You know, when I finished playing for Coach Sutton, our relationship changed. It evolved. It got better. You know, it was way more open and way more frank conversation. And he was a pretty honest coach to play for. But what was that like for you with Frank? Because you had played for Frank. We had talked about how he recruited you back to Miami way back in the day. Yeah, you only played for him for a year. Now, what is it like? What was the difference like in being part of his staff?
It was amazing. It was amazing. We had a great relationship when I was a player. We would sit up at night on the phone with each other as a collegian, and we would watch games. I remember watching the Miami Heat with him, and the Heat ran a play to get Chris Bosh like a pick and pop opportunity. And I was like, man, that'd be great. You know, and I like, he said, shoot it to me. So I like got up with my phone and videoed it and I sent it to him that night, and he put it in the next day in practice. And we just had a great connection. And I got to see that, you know, even back when he was at Miami with another guy from Baltimore, you know, Jack McClinton, he and Jack had that connection that was unreal. And when I became a coach, it just got better because we spoke the same language. We had some of the same experiences. Like, you know, we were with each other in some very, very tough moments. Like, and that, you can never replace that. I mean, we were up 19 points in Fog Allen Fieldhouse to win the Big 12 regular season championship. And we lost that game. Like, that was a crushing loss. We were 30-4 and we lost as a 2 seed to Norfolk State. Like, that was a crushing loss. We experienced some great wins together, winning a Big 12 tournament championship, beating Baylor 3 times, beating Texas 3 times, like some great experiences together. So We just had a bond that was special. And what I told him was, and I was serious at this moment, I wanted for him what Coach K had at Duke. Seeing Nate James and John Shire and Chris Carriwell or Steve Wojo or all his former players as assistant coaches. Like, I wanted that for him, that bond and that connection. And, you know, obviously I moved on and my career took me in different paths, but we had and still have an incredible relationship. I still call him and talk about his team and give him my thoughts. And, you know, I still try to help him recruit players whenever I can, you know, if I know.
I don't know if you remember this. I don't even remember this, but Shaq Harrison. Okay. Mm-hmm. So your first year there and I come do a game and I was like, wasn't Shaq Harrison like a really good football player?
Yeah, he was going to go to Kansas play football at high school, Big 12 football.
Right. And you're like, I was like, he should play football. And you're like, no, he should play basketball. He'll play in the NBA. And I was like, yeah. Come on, man. Like,
yeah.
What'd you see in him?
I saw in Shaq Harrison what I saw in the NBA. Outside of talent, outside of ridiculous talent, like the freaks, outside of the talented freaks, I saw in Shaq what translated to a long career in the league. Incredible toughness, incredible competitiveness, and an incredible work ethic. If you have those three things, the way the game is going right now, your toughness and competitiveness can spur you into a career. Like, guys are getting drafted because they have a high motor. Like, guys are getting picked up from overseas. I mean, Javon Carter, the kid Toscano Anderson, like Draymond Green. And obviously Draymond's IQ is ridiculous, but his toughness and his competitiveness are so elite. And Shaq had the work ethic. You know, he had the work ethic to go with it. He was our hardest worker. He was our toughest player. He was our most competitive. I mean, Shaq would get in an argument with one of his teammates, and his teammates like complained about something. And Shaq would say, shut the F up. I've never lost a sprint. I've never lost a sprint since I've been here. And I was just like, yeah, like, yeah. Like, think of the Last Dance clip of Michael Jordan running at the Birdo Center. I mean, who was the first one in those sprints? Like, he was.
Correct.
Like, I can say whatever I need to say on this team. I've never lost a sprint. Beat me in a sprint and then talk. Like, so he just had that chippiness and edge to him. I text Shaq like once a week still. I just text him and say, make sure you're the first one in, last one to leave. Like, I wish I had that for me when I was in the league. Someone to remind me to make sure you're the hardest worker in that organization every day.
How did the Colorado thing happen?
You know, again, not looking for a job. I mean, was just at an AAU event and it was in the spring. And I like to sit by myself when I'm out like recruiting kids in the summer, because it can be a distraction being around the coaches that haven't seen each other all year. They're talking to each other on their phone, like no one's watching games. So I'll go sit alone. You know, sometimes I do have a friend I want to sit next to, you know, but if I don't have a guy, I'll sit by myself. And Coach Boyle, nice shirt, man. Varley, nice hoodie, Varley design. I love it. I'd go sit alone. And Coach Boyle, you know, they recruit very pointedly at Colorado. So sometimes if he didn't have a kid to see at a game, he later told me he would just watch assistant coaches. He would just look and see, like, which assistants are working. And I was sitting by myself. It was a Houston Hoops versus, I think, Nike Pro Skills, Dallas Pro Skills game. And I was sitting by myself watching a big kid that we were involved with. And he just came and sat next to me. And we just sat for one half of basketball and, like, talked basketball. Like, what do you think they're going to do out of this timeout? Well, I know they better take away that kid. This ref, man, he's ready to go home. We just talked basketball for one half of basketball. Literally, that was it. Said goodbye. Now, I played against them for one season. They were in the Big 12. His first year at Colorado was my junior year at Missouri. That was it. Left that event in April at Boo Williams. Didn't have his number, didn't think of nothing. Fast forward to July. So the job season is over. This is July. It's the end. Like, I'm at the last event in Atlanta. And I'm sitting there watching a game again on the bleacher. and Beno Ransom and Mark Turgeon from Maryland were next to me. I didn't know this, but Turge and Boyle were high school college teammates at Kansas.
That undersells it. I mean, I'm sure you knew this, but Tad was in private. He was in the private sector.
Yeah. Oh, I know. He was out of it.
Turge was like, you got to come coach.
Yeah. He brought him to Oregon, and then he left Oregon to go to Jerry Green with Tennessee. Yeah. And then he left Tennessee to go to Jacksonville State with Turge. And so they're best friends. And I kind of was said, what up? Beano's from Baltimore. So I was kind of talking to Beano a little bit. And I said, what up, Turge? Turge said, what up, man? And he said, Tad Boyle's going to hire you. And I looked at him like, what? And I just like kind of shook my head. It didn't make sense. I was like, whatever. Like, Tad doesn't even have a job. Like, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, man, Tad loves you. And I like, oh, well, nice, man. He's a great guy. And that was it. Didn't think of it. So it wasn't the last weekend. Actually, it was the middle weekend. There was one more weekend in Vegas because I go to Vegas. I'm at an event. Again, I'm standing on the side of a bleacher by myself. Tad happened to be in a back row. And Tad taps me and said, hey, what up, Kim? And he says, is this still your number? And I was like, yep, that's still my number. I got the same number since seventh grade. And I was like, yep. And he's like, all right, cool, man. Good seeing you. I was like, nice seeing you too. And then I get back to Tulsa. It's August. It's our time to like relax a little bit for a couple of weeks after the July grind. And I get a call from Coach Haith saying Tad Boyle just called. He asked to speak to you. He has a position open. John Prelow is going to get San Jose State. And I was like, wow. So Tad called me. It was my first time being alone with my April, May, June, July, August, 4-month-old daughter. I was alone with her in Tulsa. And I put her to sleep, talked to Tad, talked about coming to Colorado. And I told him no. Like, I was good. I recruited Darian Jackson and Jariah Horn and Elijah Joyner. I recruited these really good future cornerstones to the Tulsa program, and I wanted to coach them. And I said, no, thanks, but no thanks. And I went to sleep, and tornadoes never hit Tulsa, like almost never, like because it's the Arkansas River. It's hilly. They usually revert and go to like northern Oklahoma. A tornado dropped down in Tulsa that night and like ravaged my neighborhood, like ravaged, like shopping centers, houses, my neighbors' houses.
What neighborhood? What part of town?
I lived in Midtown. I lived in like 51st and Sheridan around there. I'm just on the poor side of Midtown. But my house was untouched. My house was untouched with my 4-month-old baby. And I wake up the next morning, like go outside, like what? And I get a text from Tad said, any second thoughts? And I'm kid you not, if it wasn't for the tornado, I would have said, no, I'm good, man. Thanks. Good luck with your search. I was ready to help Kim Paulino try to get the job. I text back because of the tornado. I said, actually, I am having some second thoughts.
That happened to Scott Brooks. I don't know if you know that. So when Scotty was before his last year in Oklahoma City, his wife was home and they were maybe in the playoffs and there's a bad tornado and they were in the basement like all night. And she was like, I'm out. And so their last year, they moved to Orange County where he had a house because they couldn't do the tornadoes.
And honestly, if it wasn't a tornado that night, I would have probably maybe still been at the University of Tulsa right now.
Did Frank talk about the race riots, Black Wall Street, when you're at TU?
We spoke. I didn't know about it. I knew about it before I got there. I got more intimate with the story and the history of that terrorism and those riots and that mass murder that took place there. It kind of in the midst of more, race violence in the country of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and when that stuff started to become more prevalent and we saw it more, what happened in Tulsa And I think the 100-year anniversary just came up. So over the last few years, it's become more of a topic. Yeah. I knew about it. I would drive around. I mean, I honestly, I used to tell the story to any of my family or friends that used to come into Tulsa. Like, I used to show them this was Black Wall Street, this incredibly booming area right now. Like, you know, yeah, we owned and operated it, and, you know, we're thriving.
It's really interesting because Tulsa, to you, has had successful, been a launching point for a bunch of successful Black coaches, right? I mean, four or five. I mean, obviously, I mean, Tubby was amazing, Nolan, in terms of his staff there. Craig Robinson was there.
Nolan was there.
Yeah. Frank.
Coaches in general. But yeah, Black coaches for sure.
But it's very interesting that there's been a tremendous amount of diversity at Tulsa basketball specifically. And yet here's this kind of super ugly history that sometimes gets mentioned, sometimes doesn't get mentioned. It's like, I do wonder what it's like to walk around as a Black man, as a coach at Tulsa, knowing this exists and how you process that.
Well, I wouldn't say it exists at that level. I mean, that was a very radical level. It was 100 years ago. Obviously racism still exists. It's more systemic. It's more covert. That was a very overt form of racism, you know, what happened in whatever 1921 it was in Tulsa, 1920. But I'd say that it's just walking around Tulsa, it's a lot different than other places in the Deep South. It's not as strong. I mean, Booker T. Washington High School is in North Tulsa. And it's a historically Black high school. It used to be a segregated Black high school, but it's one of the most well-performing high schools in America. And white kids from all over Tulsa, Jenks, affluent neighborhoods in Tulsa, drive to get educated at Booker T. Washington. So there's some integration in Tulsa that I thought was pretty cool. Even with the Native American culture, you know, in Catoosa and Broken Arrow. I really enjoyed my time in Tulsa.
Okay, so you get to Boulder. Boulder's a different spot now.
Yeah, it is.
Different spot.
It is.
What was that like for you?
You know, it was great. It was really cool. It was different. I never lived out west. It was beautiful. It is beautiful. Seeing the Flatirons and the Rockies and the amazing weather, the sun. And, you know, it was great. It was a great mix of college town plus city. You have Boulder, and 23 miles away, you have Denver. So I lived in the middle. I lived in Broomfield. Again, didn't have enough money to live in Boulder, Colorado. It was very expensive. Didn't want to live that far in Denver. So I lived in the middle. And it was great.
What's Tad like?
I learned so much from each coach. From Frank, I feel like he's a really, really, really smart offensive coach. And the confidence that he gives his players is incredible. With Tad has an ability, man, and it's real. And it's like, as an assistant, you're like, come on, man, like, let's go. We got to be more aggressive. He thinks that there is not a better job in America than the University of Colorado at Boulder. Like, if a kid told Tad Boyle that he was going to Kentucky or Duke, sorry, coach, I made my decision. I'm going to UCLA, Kentucky or Duke. Colorado's out. He would look at that kid like the kid was a fool. He thinks Colorado is the best job in America. And that conviction in the job, what I've discovered, shine through in his recruiting. Because when he's talking to kids and parents, they really believe what he's saying. It shined through in his basketball coaching. When we're preparing for a game and he's giving a speech at halftime or we're scouting, the players feel it, how much he believes this place can be special. And it is special. It shines through in everything he does. You know, every single day Tad Boyle wakes up, he's thinking, what can I do to make Colorado basketball a champion? And he's a really good basketball coach as well.
What is it? How is style-wise, what's unique about how his teams play?
Very simple. What I realize, you know, Nate Thomason, who came with me here from Colorado, Nate likes to say, simplicity is brilliance. Tad is a very simple coach, and it is cool. I was texting with Coach Bennett the other day, and he actually sent me a biblical reference to it. It was about simplicity, like how we need to practice simplicity, and that's Tad. And you know, it becomes routine. It becomes routine. It's a lot what you hear Belichick and Saban talk about. You know, the routine of every day, the monotony of everyday work. And his best teams, when they're clicking, it's really cool to see. Their defense is sound, their offense is simple and effective.
Yeah, my brother worked for Mike Montgomery for 6 years, and he used to say simplicity and execution. Yeah. That's it. Like, what's the secret to their success? Simplicity and execution.
Yeah.
Why'd you go to Tennessee?
Again, wasn't looking. I was actually at the Final Four. I'm very fortunate in my career. I mean, I was at the Black Coaches Association, banquet. We're sitting there. I got a call from Mike Schwartz, and he says, Rob Lanier is taking Georgia State. You want to come to Tennessee? And I said, let's do it. That was the thought process. That was it. They had just come off an incredible season. They were fresh in my mind watching them in the Sweet 16 against Purdue. I love the way they play. Coach Barnes and I had gotten close over the last 4 years. When I got to Tulsa, you know, obviously he coached against me in the Big 12. Frank worked for him at Texas. Mike played for him at Texas. Was a GA for him. It was his first graduate assistant at Texas. Out on the road in the summers, Coach Barnes and I would go to have lunch and dinner with Mike or Coach Haight. And so we kind of had gotten a good relationship and rapport. And he called and said, let's do it. And Tennessee almost turned into UCLA, which was going to be like, which I didn't feel as good about. I did not want to leave Colorado for the same league. And we had just beat up on UCLA. We beat them 4 straight times. So I really wasn't like in awe of the program at the moment.
What is that like to be sitting there and you're like, do you know all these things that are going on?
I'm aware the UCLA thing is going on. And you know, it was, you know, he wanted me to go with him either way. And I told him I would have went with him either way, but I really, in the back of my mind, I was happy. I was sold on Tennessee. I didn't feel good about sitting on the opposite bench of McKinley Wright, Tyler Bay, and Deshaun Schwartz, like respectively and privately. Like, so I was happy that it was Tennessee.
I do want to talk about McKinley Wright because anybody who's watched him, and then even before you know his personal story, you're like, I love watching that kid play basketball. When was the first time you saw McKinley Wright?
August, when I got there, right before they went on a foreign tour.
Okay, so you get there, and did you know anything about him?
No, never. Never.
First impression was what?
Shaquille Harrison with more skill, a little smaller, a little less athletic, but he's Shaquille Harrison from a heart standpoint and a competitive standpoint. I didn't know about his work ethic at the first time I seen him, but in a work standpoint. He's going to make it. Like, he is, he's Jameer Nelson. He's Terrell Brandon. He's going to have a career in the league. You know,
agreed. Totally agreed. I love watching him play basketball and run a team and lead a team. He's awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I bet a point guard. You're a true point guard. I bet you would like to see him, you know, operate.
Oh, dude. I watch Colorado games just to watch him play. He's that enjoyable. Yeah. Okay. So you get to Tennessee. And they come off this great year. Yeah. Now, for people who don't know Rick is hilarious, very sarcastic, very sarcastic.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, a super interesting personality where when I was in the league, like, I didn't like him. Like, I thought he was so, he was so sarcastic on the sidelines. Like, I'd sometimes chirp to the opposing bench. He'd say some shit to me. And then I started covering him. Like, I didn't know if he didn't like me or whatever. And then he invited me to dinner one time. I was doing a Texas game, and I laughed the whole time. I was like in. And then one time after the Final Four in Dallas, I texted him like, "Hey, we're going to stay. We're thinking about coming down to Austin." He's like, "Just tell me when you show up and tell me when you leave and promise me that you'll have breakfast with me one morning." I said, "Okay." And he got us a room at the W. Yeah. And he gave me all these restaurants to go to. We went to like every restaurant was good. He gave me where to do yoga. He's an amazing dude. Okay. So you move into Knoxville. He decides not to go to UCLA. What's your experience like?
I remember the Purdue Tennessee game of 2019 and the Sweet 16. And I remember texting with McKinley and Deshaun because we had lost in the quarterfinals in the NIT to Texas. And Texas played at a speed that we hadn't seen in the Pac-12 that season. They just played at a different pace and tempo, which I know it's the tempo and pace of a Big 12. It's the Big 12. But I hadn't seen it. That speed, that pace for 4 years. And I told our team to go back and watch that Purdue-Tennessee game. Before I knew anything about Tennessee, I was going. And when I got to Tennessee, I realized my first practice why the speed and tempo was the way it was.
What is that?
It made a huge impact. It's because Coach Barnes and that staff demands it every single rep. And it was my main emphasis our spring at George Mason was I got to get these guys playing at that speed, playing at that, whereas this spring at George Mason wasn't about what we did. It was all about how we did things. And I told all of my assistant coaches, if it ain't hard enough, fast enough, strong enough, stop and make them do it again. Like, we are going to stop and do it until it's – so I've told the guys, pass the ball as hard as you can. Like, every single pass, every single chest pass, try to knock a guy over. Cut so hard you trip and fall. Like, drive the ball so hard you fall into the wall. Like, run every single time as hard as you can run. So run as hard as you can run, cut as hard as you can cut, drive as hard as you can drive, pass as hard as you can pass. Like, that was our spring. And it looked sloppy. It looked crazy at times. Guys were falling. Guys were missing passes. But it was like, I was like, good. Like, they got to get to the level that I'm used to, that I'm accustomed to, you know, because when it's done right, it can be overwhelming. You know, our tempo and our pace, when we were right at Tennessee, overwhelmed teams. And I felt it as a player at Missouri, and we're going to get that level of speed and execution here at Mason.
This last year at Tennessee, you had two super, super talented young guards. What was it like to work with Jade and Keon?
It was great. You know, I feel like they got shortchanged, like every elite freshman in the country this year, from Kentucky, Duke to us. Kate Cunningham, very few freshmen had great success this year, like from a winning and playing standpoint. Like, those guys, we won. I mean, we were a tournament team. They played well, but it wasn't at the level it should have. If we could have had a full summer with them, 8 weeks of 4 hours a week, if we could have had a real fall and an inter-squad scrimmage, a real scrimmage, at Tennessee, we scrimmage Davidson every year. If we could have had 12 non-conference games with those guys, it would have been so much more special than it was. You know, they had a summer of us coaching them from the balcony. Like, you know, we had to think about social distance and practice, and we couldn't. It was disappointing because I think those guys are, I won't coach guys as talented as that much in my career. So it was great to see their greatness in games and in days in practice, especially Keon. I kind of am disappointed that COVID happened and it didn't get to be the development and the culture that we usually have at Tennessee.
Okay, so COVID hits, the world shuts down, okay, stops. What are you doing?
It was I got in a routine. I got up. I had days with my daughters. play with them all day, which was great to get to spend that much time with my girls. I watched the news all day, go outside. And I would talk to Coach Barnes, talk to our players. We just try to make little like Zoom projects. We do like Zoom film sessions with our current players, tried to recruit as best we could, you know, to finish up our 2021 class, our 2021 class. Yeah. That was Kennedy Chandler. You know, we were still recruiting Paulo Banchero pretty hard at that time. It was very surreal. It was scary, you know, from a standpoint of not knowing when this was going to end, not knowing if college basketball was going to still be a thing. You know, and then finally we got sports again. Finally we got sports again, and that kind of made things a little bit better, back to normal.
Okay. So how did the George Mason thing come to be?
You know, it's always been a job that I've kind of looked at as if there was ever an opportunity, I would do anything I could to get involved. And from the moment it opened, I was very fortunate that there was mutual interest. And we spoke. Coach Barnes actually got his start here as a 32-year-old head coach. So that there was a connection there, and that really excited him. And when I spoke to the athletic director, Brad Edwards, who played in the NFL, who was a Super Bowl championship ring, when I spoke to the president, Dr. Greg Washington, hearing the alignment between those guys, hearing Dr. Washington's understanding of how important intercollegiate athletics and especially basketball is, it really got me excited. And then once I heard that from them, it just became me letting them know that I was ready to lead, letting them hear my basketball plan and my vision for this program and how we're going to get it done.
So what is the vision? What is what's the step-by-step process? You get the, okay, let's start with this. You get the job. Who mm-hmm. called you and told you got the job?
The athletic director.
Okay. So he calls you. Mm-hmm. And at the time somebody tells, this is a question did you discuss salary before?
Any job I've had, not Tulsa, not any job. I mean, playing professionally, I've never, ever one time asked what the money, I found out what my salary was when I looked at my contract, when I was here.
Want the job? Do you say you have the job? What's that conversation?
Now, Brad was in talks with CAA.
Yeah.
He was with Evan Daniels, Jimmy Sexton. He was talking to those guys. They talk numbers. Again, I let those guys know it was not about money for me. So he called me. You know, I had a great talk with the president the day before. I talked with the deputy AD, Dr. Debbie Corbato, who is spectacular. And he called me. I was driving back to Knoxville from Missouri, and he said, "Are you ready to do this?" And I said, "Absolutely." And he said, "All right, let's keep it on the low." So I couldn't say anything, got right to it. Got off the phone with him, and I called the guys that I would want to come with me, my staff, and told them.
All right, so this may cause some staff dissension. Who was the first call?
Nate Thomason. He kind of known. I was involved with another job before. It was a Power 5 job I was involved with. And Nate knew. Nate's one of my closest friends in the business. Played against each other in prep school. Played against each other in the Big 12. Worked with him at Colorado. He's Australian. And the colors of the Boomers are green and gold. So we were in the bubble. Both of us were in the bubble. They were still playing. We got bumped in the first round. Oregon State played, thanks to your brother's recruiting. He knew I was involved with it the whole time. And he says, "All right, I'm going to lock into Georgetown and then Florida State." He said, "Just if it happens, just text me green and gold." And I could probably find it. I just text him in like all caps. I said, "Green and gold," with like a million explanation points, like green and gold, the color of the Boomers and the color of George Mason basketball. So he was the first one I called.
Okay. So when you're putting together pieces, is it about guys you're close with that you trust, or you're like, all right, well, I get Nate and Nate does this and he's international. And then I got this guy, he's Baltimore. How'd you decide to put together the staff?
Yeah. For me, it's about integrity, intelligence, and work ethic. Like, if I'm close to you or not, like if I know you're good, if I know if people around me that I do, I have to know people around you. I don't have to know you, but I have to know people around you that can vouch for your integrity. I can find out in a second if someone's good and if they work hard, if they're intelligent. So, I mean, my staff is that. I mean, Nate Tomlinson, I think, will be an NBA head coach one day. Brilliant, really good recruiter domestically and internationally. I mean, Colorado's recruiting class is eighth in the nation this year, and Nate had a big part in that. He's a coach's kid. He's super sharp, smart, knows the game. You know, Dennis Felton, who I got to work with intimately at Tulsa, is bright. I mean, been in it a long time.
He's like your old, he is your old head. Like, I know you trust him and respect him,
I trust him and respect him intimately. I mean, he built a monster.
Integrity, what they had, you know, like.
He built a mid-major monster at Western Kentucky, and a great person. You know, I wanted to have someone from the area, but I wasn't going to just get some random person from the area that I didn't trust deeply. And so I was actually talking to a lot of guys from the area that really good candidates that I really, really liked and was seriously considering. But when I got here and sat down with Dwayne Simpkins, it changed from me like saying, oh, I'll retain him. Like, oh, I'll just keep him. It turned into, I really, really, really want this guy. Like he had other jobs. I mean, you know, Tennessee was talking about Dwayne Simpkins to replace me there. Like, so it flipped, like in one meeting, it flipped from me convincing Dwayne Simpkins to stay here. And I am like, we are lucky to have Dwayne Simpkins, who is a McDonald's All-American, who played for a Naismith Hall of Fame high school coach in Morgan Wooten, and played for a Naismith Hall of Fame college coach at Maryland, who was a 6-foot point guard. So he knows the scrappiness and toughness and competitiveness that we talk about. So he's been great. He's been great bridging the gap with our players, recruiting the area, and his institutional knowledge has been incredibly incredible. This is his seventh season here. So I'm really excited about my three assistant coaches. IJ Poole is a young, hungry, very talented guy that I worked with at Tennessee. He was actually a 24-year-old assistant coach at Appalachian State for two seasons. He was a manager at Texas for coach, a grad assistant at Tennessee. He did video stuff for us last year at Tennessee, and he's a director of scouting and player personnel. My ops guy is the academic coordinator from the University of Virginia basketball. He was there for 11 seasons with Coach Bennett. Has Coach Bennett been there for 11 years? It has been 11 years. Yeah. He was at Duke and Notre Dame before that. I met him on a Zoom mid-pandemic. I was on a Zoom with a guy named Daniel Marks from the Bucks. He had a Zoom talking about athletics, just kind of pushing athletes through the system and not valuing education. So I was on that Zoom as a panelist with a professor from some school, and me and the professor went at odds. He was kind of casting some generalizations on athletes and black athletes in particular. So me and that professor kind of went at it toe to toe, and I didn't know it. TJ Grahams, my now ops guy, was on that Zoom, and he got my email. I'm really close with a lot of guys on the Virginia staff. Johnny Carpenter being one of them, who's one of the smartest people in our game. And Johnny said, hey, our academics guy asked for your number. He was on your Zoom call tonight. And I was like, yeah, give it to him. And TJ and I talked, and he was like, man, I love that. Like, that was awesome. And he told me he had an interest of possibly working on the basketball side.
What was it that you challenged the guy on, the professor on? What was the generalization? I don't remember
specifically, because now it was two springs ago now, or one spring. I don't even know.
Stop that, because you remember everything.
I know. Everything. I remember he said something like, I think we were talking about the how athletes just get kind of pushed through. Like, just it's more about eligibility than like excellence in education. It's more about eligibility than graduation, is what he was saying. And that's true in a lot of places. But he was saying the athletes don't care about that. The athletes are pushing that. And I thought that couldn't be further from the truth.
I disagree. It depends on the kid.
Exactly. It's not my argument to him was Black college athletes aren't monolithic. Like, there's not one thing that we all do. It's a million different things. Just like I couldn't say all professors.
I'll give you an example. Okay. So when I was at Notre Dame, you have to take freshman studies. So you get thrown into the pool and it's a smaller school, brilliant people. And so I remember I had to take like biochem and some high level math. And if I didn't have Antoni Weish, who's an assistant obviously at Siena, if I didn't have Tone in my class, I was done. Yeah. Done. I'm not even talking about peaking, just the, and that comes from his family and his desire to work. Yeah. When I was at Oklahoma State, Adrian Peterson, our third all-time leading scorer, like that dude was brilliant. Yeah. It went across racial bounds.
Yeah. So that was my argument.
It didn't matter. It's all based upon the kid, what his parents, high school coaches demanded, and frankly, what the coach demands of his players. But mostly it does come down to the kid. And if the kid is there, it's a lot like you said about coaching when you started. Like coaches get into the business for the wrong reason. There are players that are in this thing for the wrong reason. And some figure it out and some don't.
Right.
And it always bothers me when people say, well, guys just get pushed along. They get, well, again, you're assuming you know every player. There are some guys who are just going to try and get by.
Yeah, no, it was ridiculous. And we went at it and it was good. It was fine. It ended well. And Daniel loved it. And it's funny you say that. One of the most successful former Mason players just walked in. I'm going to visit with him here in a little bit. Steve Neal, who's a very successful businessman in the area. I was kind of, as you were talking, I was just kind of watching him walk in. He's incredible. I mean, he's been a vice president for a huge grocery store here locally, Giant Foods. Now he has a busing and trucking company. So, no. Yeah, we dictate. This is higher education. We are part of the higher education process. So, you know, as a basketball coach, for me especially, that education is going to extend beyond the classroom and onto what we do.
So, okay, here's what's important. Now you get a team. It's your team.
Yeah. Okay?
The buck stops there. You can play however you want.
Yeah.
Okay. You've played for two head coaches in college that played very different styles.
Yeah.
You played for five different high schools. I'm sure they played different styles, plus AAU programs. Okay. You played in the NBA. You played overseas. You have all of this knowledge in your head where you recall every play and whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. Two questions in one. First, how do you want to play? And second, can you play that way in year one, considering you haven't gotten a chance to change all of your personnel to how you truly desire to play?
I think we can. I think we can play the way we want to play in year one. I don't know it. You know, I don't know it until I actually see all the pieces together. Right now, it's some new guys mixed with some old guys and a lot of video. Haven't seen those guys all meshing. So I think this summer is going to dictate truly, you know, what is it we do best? You know, what gives us the best chance at winning? You know, if it's you're talking Kelvin Sampson, it's defense and rebounding. If you're talking Mark Few and Gonzaga, it's an offensive juggernaut. They're going to score more points than you because they're just really good at scoring points. So, in my mind, we're going to be a team that is focused on defense and rebounding. And, you know, we're going to pick up 94 feet. We're not going to be it's going to be a little bit. I hate to say this. It's going to be a little bit of a lot of the things I've experienced. I want to extend defensively, and then later in the possession, I want to protect the paint. You know, I know that, but what's most important is that our guys know. Like, that's a great question. You said the buck stops with me, and it does, right? But it's my job, it's our job as a staff to get all that intelligence that I just talked about on our staff, to get that intelligence onto the court. We need to get that intelligence and that identity onto the court. So it's
it also all has to work together, right? Because
sure, for me, you can't talk offense without talking defense. Our defense and our offense are married, right? Like, and I hate when coaches say, "Yeah, we're going to play fast. We're going to play up tempo." Like, good offense is neither fast nor slow. Good offense is efficient. You know, good offense is efficient. Good offense is coupled with great transition defense. You know, good half court defense is coupled with a good transition offense. You know, so our mission defensively is to keep the ball out of the paint, take away threes from good shooters, contest every shot, and limit them to one. Offensively, if we get a defensive rebound and a stop, which we're going to be a good defensive team, our guys have the first 7 seconds of the possession to play, man. Get downhill. I got two rules in transition offense. Run as hard as you can possibly run and pass to someone if they're open. In transition, it's theirs. They have the freedom to do what they want in transition, knowing that I want to lay up a free throw or an open three in transition. And then after that 7 seconds, we're going to be in what we call playing the game. It's going to be four out, one in, five out, principle-based offense. You know, I talk to our guys all the time about shared cognition in our offense. If a player on the right wing is driving baseline, the other four guys knowing exactly where they need to be on that baseline drive, and the driver knowing exactly where the other four guys need to be. If he's driving middle, the other four guys knowing exactly where they need to be. If Malik Henry is coming to set a ball screen, the guy with the ball and the other three guys knowing exactly what Malik Henry is going to do. Is he roll? Is he pop? Is he short roll? If it's Blake Jones from Australia, who's a 6'9" shooter, Blake Jones is popping, right? So, like, it's going to be, you know, I think it's going to be fun offensively. And, you know, our mission on offense is to take care of the ball and get a great shot. So, very simple. Very simple, like very simple sounding things, but you know, us being able to implement it, but most importantly, our guys being able to more than verbalize it, do the things we want, know who we are as a team. You know, those guys knowing our identity and our staff, we're not doing ourselves any favors if we're hoarding all this information and knowledge on the bench. Get that information onto the court. We need our guys to be smarter than their guys.
Okay, last thing. What will determine your personal feelings of success in year one?
Yeah, it's on a very singular day-to-day possession by possession basis. Like when people what is that? Like what, 20 wins? All right, what if you win 20 games and you got 3 games left to go in the season? Like, what is it, getting to the NCAA tournament? All right, what if you get to the NCAA tournament? Like, now what? Are you going to say, hey, guys, let's pack it in, man. Great job. We reached our goal. Our goals are going to be very process-oriented. Like, our goals, and I could go on a tangent, but, like, our goal for, like, the whole season is to, on the rise of our shot on offense, our goal is to have three guys going to offensive rebound and one guy sprinting back as hard as he can. And that guy that's back is back. He's pointing and hollering. And the guys that did go to the glass, they didn't get it. Those guys are running as hard as they can run back in transition defense. And then we're building a wall to keep the other team out the paint. We're getting matchups. We're identifying shooters. We're not allowing any zero pass paint touches, not allowing any kick ahead threes. We're keeping the ball out of the paint. We're closing out with high hands. We're playing defense without fouling. We're executing our pick and roll coverage at the point of the screen, hitting people, not being soft, right? On the rise of the shot, it's not looking at the flight of the ball. It's finding who's coming to you, and it's laying the wood. It's hitting them as hard as you can. It's going to get the rebound with two hands, securing the rebound, looking up the court. Like, for me, that's a goal achieved. Like, that's our goal for this season, to be able to do that. And then on offense, it's running as hard as you can. It's passing to someone if they're open. it's taking care of the ball. It's playing unselfishly. It's playing in a possession to find the absolute best shot for our team. And then it's on the rise of the shot, doing exactly what I just said. Like, that's my goal.
That's my process. Goal
for this season is that that's all I want our players thinking about.
Yeah.
Because nothing, no goal that I could say matters right now on May 20th. Like, the only goal is to get what I just described to you. Like, and if we can literally focus in and hone in on that, those responsibilities, every single possession, I feel great about the outcome of our season.
It's interesting that in our last pod, you talked about how you believe you succeeded at Missouri because you failed at first. You know, when you first got there, we were the 13 out of 13. And that, you know, one of the reasons you felt like you guys lost to Norfolk State was because you succeeded in the Big 12 tournament. And then because you succeeded in summer league, it took away a little bit of your hunger in the NBA, and it hurt your season with the Pistons.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I wonder if that will be the case at Mason, right? Like, if you struggle out of the gate, because I'll just give you a perfect personal example. So I coached the Maccabi Games team. It's the Jewish Olympics. And, you know, I, like anybody, you think you have all the answers. You think you know what you're doing. You go through practices leading up to it. Guys are like, oh, this is amazing. You're awesome. So we go and we play the Israeli junior national team. And, you know, we get good players. And we're down 22-2 to start the game. And I call a timeout. It's just a friendly. Right? And I call a timeout. And I'm sitting there to myself, all right, maybe I don't know what I'm doing. I had come with the idea in mind. I have these two, like, Jewish ones, like 6'11", the other one's like 6'10". And so I scrapped it and I went small and we made it competitive. And I think we lost by like 6 or 8 or whatever, but I was messing around with how I wanted to guard the ball screen in the second half, and it probably cost us points. But what you said rang true, which was, I've been thinking about this since we last talked, which was, had that not happened, I would have walked around thinking I knew exactly what I was doing and been wrong. And, you know, we won that tournament because of my ability to change on the fly and figure out to go small, to go big. And I also changed my whole philosophy about playing small, coaching in that tournament. And something somebody told me when I was interviewing for a job once, were like, hey, look, you know a lot of basketball. You're going to learn more coaching one college basketball game than you've learned the whole rest of your life. Right? You just, there's so many things that happen in one college basketball game. And I wonder for you what that's going to be like, because you know what you're doing. You know the game. You've done it. You've lived it. You've seen it. You felt it. And you have great instincts for what you should do. But it's just different. And I wonder if immediate success in your will plant a negative seed in your mind. Like, what happens if you guys start out 10-0?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not.
It's the worst thing. I'd rather lose at first.
No. It's not about that. You know, it's there's a Japanese word called kaizen, K-A-I-Z-E-N, and kaizen means continual growth. Like, continual growth is all that matters. Like, growth is all that matters. Rudyard Kipling and all these innuendos, but like they reign true when you really do make them who you are. Like Rudyard Kipling says, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, they're imposters. If we are building our team, and would you ask me about what my goal was, and I described to you our defense possession and our offense possession, if we are getting better in that and losing games, we're just going to keep getting better in those things. Like, we know no coach in the world is going to argue that those things aren't the reason teams win basketball games. By forcing teams into tough contested shots, getting first shot rebounds, taking care of the ball, getting your best players the best shots. Like, if we win our first few games, and we're going to have a beast of a schedule. If we win our first few games, like, we're going to continue to get better at those things. Like, it's not, I'm beyond that point now. where success or failure is going to make me think I'm like hot stuff, right? Like, I know I'm not that good. That's why I work extremely hard. Stephen Curry and Damian Lillard, who are ridiculously good. When you hear those guys after 50-point games, they talk about still having things they have to work on. It's because of the work I put in. So, you know, if I'm preaching that to our team, it's the same with me. It's the same with our staff. Like, how are we getting better every day? No matter the outcome. No matter the outcome. Like, things are never as good as they seem. Things are never as bad as they seem. You know, so it's not about the outcome. It's about what we are doing. Are we doing the things that we value as important?
I appreciate this time. I know you got to go, and I got a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah, I
got
to talk to Steve Neal, man. He's a George Mason great.
Go do that. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, brother. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man.
All right.
Remember to listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you download podcasts. In the meantime, download, subscribe, rate, write a review. If you like it, you don't like it, hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.